Good morning, Justices Crump and Theofanis and myself. Welcome you to the Third Court of Appeals. We're hearing today cause number 03-25-493-CR, Burdison versus State of Texas. If I can have counsel state their name for the record, please.
Yes, Chief Justice, good morning. Jesse Furrick for Appellant Renisha Burdison.
Thank you.
Good morning. Stephanie Newell, District Attorney, Bell County, for Appellant.
Thank you so much. And counsels, just to update you, we are broadcasting this live on our YouTube channel. It will be available for you later for review, as well as the green light means that you've got 15 minutes, and for you it'll mean 20 minutes, and then the yellow light means you've got 2 minutes to wrap up your comments. Red light means you need to wrap up your thoughts so that we can pass it off to the next council or in your thoughts. So with that, let's go ahead and turn it over to the appellant. Thank you.
May it please the court, District Attorney Newell. A jury charge that fails to require the state to prove every contested element beyond a reasonable doubt, that omits an abstract definition that vitally affects a defensive theory, and that includes and emphasizes unindicted theories in the application paragraph, is a jury charge that causes egregious harm. And that's what we have here. The jury charge in this case has no less than six errors, two of which concern the complete omission of abduct, which is the distinguishing element of kidnapping, from the entirety of the charge. Another fails to include a definition of in loco parentis, which was crucial to the defensive theory in this case. Another erroneously includes uncharged statutory manner and means in two parts of the application paragraph, and two others include incorrect mental state definitions of intentionally and knowingly. For these reasons, the state's briefed position that there are no errors in the jury charge is without merit. Instead, the court's focus should be on whether or not one or more of these errors caused egregious harm. And in a case with such sharply different narratives, when at least four of these errors all prevent the jury from giving effect to defensive theories, affect the very basis of the case, or deprive the accused of the valuable right of due process, these errors can only cause egregious harm. Before I get into talking about egregious harm, I just want to say to give you a roadmap for where I'm going, because our request for argument said we wanted to focus on the charge. I'm going to do that unless the panel directs me elsewhere. So if that works,
one of the things, counsels, that is concerning most to me is the sexual offender registration and the concern that the court has that your client has already filed one habeas asserting ineffective assistance of counsel and has gotten findings of fact of ineffective assistance of counsel, and the argument by the state that the pathway by which your client would raise the issue of asserting that registration concern would be by filing yet another habeas. And my concern is that pathway foreclosed for your client because your client has already asserted ineffective assistance of counsel once and had that finding? So is it res judicata that you can't raise that again, asserting ineffective assistance of counsel, so that you can go back and assert that again to get a motion for new trial now that you didn't get in your first habeas? Or is that pathway open? Or in a second habeas, can you simply assert a habeas for seeking a due process violation for your client to do an as-applied violation for your client of due process for having to register as a sex offender?
Yes, ma'am. I appreciate that concern. And my answer is two parts. I do not believe that the habeas, where we sought an out-of-time direct appeal, you can tell from volumes 2 and 3 of the clerk's record, we fought really hard to get our right to appeal back. And so taking 1107 out-of-time cases and applying them to 1107-2 cases, it's my position that our out-of-time habeas does not foreclose us seeking habeas later on an ineffective claim. However, I do believe habeas is foreclosed for constitutional challenges. And I don't love the idea of raising an ineffective assistance of counsel for failure to make constitutional challenges on an unsettled area of law, because that's not usually going to go well on the deficient performance prong of Strickland. So I believe that in order for us to really get to a good, hopefully we don't have to, but if we do, to get to a position to properly litigate ineffective assistance of counsel claims for the failure to properly advise on registration and litigate that accordingly, I do believe we need an out-of-time motion for a motion for new trial first, so we can raise those as-applied challenges, because those would be foreclosed to us on habeas, is my position.
And is there any case law that you can direct the court to that authorizes this court to lean into authorizing Rule 2 to allow that out-of-time motion for new trial, or is that also a new pathway versus a some kind of due process or I'm interested to hear why you think a constitutional challenge in as applied versus a facial attack on due process is foreclosed by your client on utilizing habeas.
As to the facial challenge, I do feel that if I'm going to raise ineffective assistance, it would be as to failure to facially challenge the
agree with you.
Yes,
but
ma'am.
I'm not talking about a facial, I'm right. Talking about an as applied.
Yes, ma'am. So I think in order for me to raise ineffective assistance as an as-applied challenge, I think I have to try at least to litigate that first in a motion for new trial. If I'm not able, I will of course still try, and then I've got an explanation for why this was my only option because I tried. The reason I raised this issue is because I didn't want to get into a position where if I have to get to a writ, somebody says, you should have tried to get your out-of-time motion for new trial first and you didn't, and so a writ's inappropriate. So I'm trying to make sure I've exhausted every possible procedural step that I can, so that when I get there, nobody says I've got a procedural problem. So it is in the spirit of being thorough and making sure that if God forbid I do get to that procedural point, the arguments to bar me from doing that are not credible.
In any case law that you have that the court can rely or lean into on a Rule 2 usage to get you to an out-of-time motion for new trial?
Beyond what I've briefed, I don't have anything additional. I do think a distinguishing feature from some of our cases that we cited are here, we do have a total deprivation of counsel at the motion for new trial phase. Some of the cases are maybe you've got a day or two left, and so, you know, maybe there was time, but here we've clearly got a complete deprivation of counsel, so I think that makes our position much stronger, and I know we have to be able to articulate for you facially plausible claims. We can't just say, hey, it would have been nice to have this opportunity, let me think about what I would do with it. And I think citing to DeWalt, which I know is a case that originally did come from this court, thank goodness we have that really great memo statement from Judge Cochran that does such a good job of laying out the history of the statute. It's a really interesting history. So I think because we've given you a facially plausible claim that directly applies to the client, and we have a total deprivation of counsel, I think the cases that we've cited let you give us relief in that way.
But if DeWalt, who was a mom, still had to register as a sex offender, and your client is not a mom, and she's arguably having to register as a sex offender, how do you feel your client will fare in light of DeWalt?
There is the difference in the parental, the undisputed parental relationship in DeWalt, and here, as was the issue at trial, is the standing of my client to this child. And I know the panel has extensive family law experience. I am not a family law attorney, so I am not going to act like I am. But from what I understand, the age of the child is a really significant issue in the family law context for my client establishing standing. And so I know there was a lot said at trial about what legal process did she go through, and as I understand it, in order for my client to have started the process, the child would have had to have been at least 6 months, because I believe you have to have substantial past contacts. So I know we have a little bit of a gap there, but I think we still do have a really good argument that she was in loco parentis to this child, and so I recognize the technical difference in the relationship than we had in DeWalt, but I don't think that that forecloses us.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Sorry to derail you.
Well, no.
While we're on that, I have some questions as well.
Yes, Your Honor.
So from the record, originally it looked like there was an 1107 writ filed and then correct assessment that it needed to be an 1107-2, and we have what looks like sort of contradictory findings from the trial court. It's sort of sequentially day, 31st, then the 1st. Can you give us a little insight into, how do these findings interact with one another? How do we look at them on appeal? I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that.
Yes, ma'am. So originally the court entered findings saying we were not entitled to our out of time appeal and found that counsel was not ineffective, and then with some background negotiations we were able to come to an agreement where the state ultimately said they were in agreement and submitted findings in accordance with that. And so the trial court did a docket entry withdrawing the original set of findings and then entering the findings that entitled us to relief, and the backstory on that was very difficult negotiations.
Okay, and then another record question, what does the record reflect in terms of when your client became aware of the need for sex offender registration with this type of conviction?
In the record, it is difficult to determine. I think the habeas record in volumes 2 and 3 help us a little bit more. It became clear that that was an issue between guilt, innocence, and punishment. And it was an off-the-record conversation where I believe the judge, from what I understand, again, I wasn't there, but from my secondhand understanding was Judge Faulkner realized that he was going to have to make an affirmative finding under 42A about the age, and so he made everybody aware of that, and then I think it was the prosecutor who said, oh, shoot, then that finding triggers an obligation, and I believe then made defense counsel aware. That was what was explained to me secondhand. And again, in volumes 2 and 3 from the habeas record, you will see affidavits from that where my client and her mother and a friend that was present at trial all talk about the shock and surprise in learning that there was a sex offender registration consequence and the devastation from that that followed.
And what consequence does that have for us in terms of preservation, that she was represented at a moment when she became aware of that need? How do we consider that when we're assessing?
For out of time purposes, I'm not sure that it really matters either way. I know the state's position is, well, then there was an opportunity to object. I will say I think that, yes, obviously there was an opportunity, but I think because it really dawned on everybody in the moment, I don't think trial counsel appreciated or even processed what that meant. I don't think that that's dispositive. I know the state says, well, then they could have objected and preserved it. And if that's ultimately what the court follows, then I appreciate I'm stuck with habeas, but I don't think that that should be dispositive, because either way, I think it's undisputed that they found out during this period of time, and I don't even think they thought about it very hard.
Is there a statutory bar that prevents her from seeking early termination from the sex offender registration?
I don't believe that there's a statutory bar. I've done a little bit of deregistration work, so if I'm going off the top of my head correctly, one of the big qualifiers for deregistration is a single count, so we have that here. But what, obviously, then there's the other steps, the therapy, and I'll tell you, when I was thinking about if that ends up being my only option for relief for her, thinking about how does somebody even go through the deregistration process for an offense that has no sexual aspect to it? Like, what do you tell the therapist that does the report that's asking you all of these sex-related questions and determining your risk to reoffend in a case that just has no sexual or abusive aspect to it? I don't know the answer to that, but that was just something that really dawned on me, which is if that ends up being the only thing I can do for her, I don't even know how we can necessarily get through the process, because I don't know how you can do a sex offender evaluation for a case that has no sex component to it. So I don't have a good answer for you on that, but it will be a journey, unfortunately, if we get there, and I hope we don't get there.
Thank you, counsel. And again, I apologize for derailing your charge.
No.
Obviously, we have read your brief on all the charge aspects, which are numerous. Counsel, I'd like to give mm-hmm. you about five more minutes if we could. I don't know whether the timer, I've got 9:26, but I'd like to give you five more minutes, and primarily I'd like to focus on I can't even say it, the Latin
in loco
matter
parentis.
That was failed to be
yes,
defined in loco parentis.
In loco parentis.
And I know that the charge mentions in the charge that you use the common, what is it? You give terms their common meaning unless you've been told that in these instructions that the terms are given special meanings.
Mm-hmm.
And I find Latin is not typically one of those languages that are taught in our elementary or middle schools or high schools in most public schools in the United States, which public schools are going by the wayside under the present administration. So I'd be interested to, and I've read your brief about the family law code and the definition being restricted over here. So I'd be interested to know how a jury is supposed to know what that phrase means.
And that's my concern, Chief Justice. And I'll tell you, I wasn't smart enough to stay in Spanish, so maybe I'm one of the few people that took Latin. And I'll tell you, I still had to look it up and really sort through. And I'll tell you, looking at family law cases as well as the handful of criminal cases, there obviously is just kind of the standard first part of the definition, which is the person stands in the place of the parent, but then the language that follows does vary quite a bit. And so yesterday, y'all may have seen that I said there may be an additional case that I would mention, and it's the Ray case, 2009 from the CCA, and it's not directly on point, but it does talk about the abandonment statute, and the issue was construing care, custody, and control under 2204, and defining in loco parentis came up there, and they looked at the family code 151, I think .001, and there was a definition that is in a head note that I really liked, because I know with the 9.61 definition, I appreciate that there's some challenges there. I have to acknowledge them, saying about whether or not we're limited in being able to use that 9.61 definition in the context of kidnapping. And so the Ray case, I think, gives us a common law family code definition of it that I think would also work. But to your point, Latin is not a English term, it is not an ordinary term, and that was really, I think, a huge crux of this case, which is my client had taken care of this child her whole life, and her position was we were getting ready to go through at the appropriate time the adoption process, but in the meantime, I am standing in the place of the parent for this child, and so we need a definition to be able to effectuate her defensive theory.
But we don't have any objection on the record. Correct. The only objection to the charge related to the lesser included offense, correct?
Yes, ma'am. The charge conference
so
is sad.
How are we to deal with that for the first time on appeal?
Yeah, it's unobjected to, jury charge error, so egregious harm.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
For all, in loco parentis definition as well as the other?
Yes, ma'am. All of these errors that we've raised, none were objected to. To just give you a little bit of an idea about what happened at the charge conference, because I know the state's position is to the statutory manner and means error.
And you have 2 minutes, Counsel.
Thank you, yes. Talking about the inclusion of the force, threat, or deception part that was included, I went back and I looked at the charge conference because I know the state doesn't think that that had any effect because nobody put any evidence on to support that theory. But when I look back at the charge conference, I can't really figure out then the state saw that this language was included in the definition of restraint and in the application paragraph. And they went so far, I think it's on 8 RR 11 and 12, to add the any means, so B, the part B of the definition. Add it, because what was there was just force, threat, and deception. So they added it in the definition, said add it in the application, but then didn't take out force, threat, or deception. So you looked at it, and you didn't take it out, you left it there. So I have to think that that was on purpose. So all to say, all of these errors, that was affirmatively one where I think we have evidence in the record that that was seen, that was not removed. And so even if it's not objected to by the defense, I still think that that's a consideration you can make when you look at it. You gave me 5 extra minutes. I'll sit down and let the state come up and then see everybody in rebuttal. Thank you so much.
Thank you, counsel. Appreciate you. Let's hear from the state. Thank you, ma'am. And if you need 5 extra minutes, I'll give that to you too as well.
I please the court and appellant. I am going to lay it all bare and say that the writer of this brief, Mr. Guy, is our appeals attorney who's currently deployed. And so I'm relying heavily on his briefing of this matter for this oral argument. And I would stand behind the law, and I know that we do not want to waste the court's time by just regurgitating what is in the brief. Just to answer some of the questions I heard during appellant's time, I think in locus parentis definition not being included, I think he's got a very good argument about the harm because it was not a defensive theory, was never raised in the evidence. And that's in regards to a parent giving permission for this person to take the child, and the only evidence or the evidence on the record was that the permission didn't come from another parent. It came from the parent who was seeking to find his child on the date of the kidnapping. And I think that's both parties as to whether they received that child in custody of the child from the father and then had an arrangement to bring that child back the next day. And then they left town and were deceptive in their location and discontinued contact with a parent with
counsel,
the legal
there
authority.
There was things in the record that indicated that the Vertisons had previously taken this child, like, to Austin and to Temple and to this same town, and that Mr. Love had not made any complaints there. Now, I can't fully remember whether he knew about every trip, but he did testify about, now, it wasn't that they were taking them to Temple or to Colleen, I can't remember. He said a few things. So it did seem like Mr. Love was okay with the Vertisons taking them to, you know, Temple or to a certain number of other places. Was there some kind of geographic mapping that he did give consent for, but it didn't go quite to Irving?
I don't believe that bears out in the record, no, Your Honor. Okay. I think this is more of a case of I could give consent for my children to go a lot of places, and some of them far distances. I might allow my child to go to Colorado with an individual, but once I say I would like my child back and we have arrangements for me to pick up my child at a, you know, Bell County being that geographical location, and they skipped town and cut contact. I think as a parent, you have that concern. Contact the police and the deception continues. So I don't think it's a geographical restriction. I think it is based on the consent of the legal parent, and nothing in the record establishes that this parent, his mother or his father, did not have all the rights that go along with that.
And what does the state make of Ms. Bertison's argument in the briefing that really the only reason why Mr. Love did any of this is because the state was strong-arming him with a threat of a charge of abandonment?
Well, obviously there'd been the police involvement the day before, but the arrangement that was made to return the child was for them to have the child overnight. And I think that's why the state called this a babysitting situation, that I've got to work tomorrow morning, he was there late into the evening, and that he needs to be the one, because of that police involvement, he was taking custody of that child.
Okay. So to you, that threat of abandonment charge and all those emails about, I'm fine, you guys, I'll see you later, we'll drop those papers.
Yeah, hit me up later, we'll come to an agreement. I absolutely can see that the facts bear that out, that there was some discussion in regards to what the custody arrangements were going to be for the child, but there was nothing in place at the time, and this parent had the absolute legal authority to, obtain the possession of the child.
One factual clarification with regard to that. There seem to be conflicts in assertions about the record. Is there any evidence that the father had renounced his paternity right?
No, Your Honor, there's no evidence on the record that he had actually renounced that paternity. I think during his testimony, you will see that there was an acknowledgement of paternity that was entered, that were signed both by father and mother, and had no inclusion, obviously, of the Vertisons, because they had no legal rights to this child. Now, if they had been caregivers through mom's consent, I think if this was a case of mom had given consent and they had skipped town, then there would be different defensive issues. But this was someone who had the legal right as father, and they actually make a misstatement that they're returning him to the mother. And we're talking about an infant. So anywhere you take that child, you're restraining them because they're not able to get up and walk out any door on their own. And it's obviously a place not likely to be found when there's subterfuge and complete disconnect of communication, and that law enforcement resources have to be located to find that child.
Do you think that, or does the state argue that in locus parentis has a common meaning that the jurors were presumed to have understood?
I think that you will find that argument contained in the brief, yes.
And counsel, with regard to the habeas argument, do you foresee Ms. Bertison being faced with a res judicata argument to the extent she raises yet another ineffective assistance of counsel argument in a second habeas asserting ineffective assistance of counsel? If she raises ineffective assistance of counsel to seek a out of time motion for new trial wherein she asserts, I was precluded from asserting my ability to seek a motion for new trial related to this registration as a for the sexual predator situation that she's facing. Do you envision that the state is going to assert, well, you're precluded because you've already sought a habeas on ineffective assistance of counsel on the out of time notice of appeal, and you didn't raise the issue of the motion for new trial, and so you're precluded from raising that ineffective assistance of counsel? argument a second time.
I do think that the state could and would have that argument on a second writ. Yes, I do. Because that writ of habeas was filed, and now by agreement we're here, that there was an out-of-time appeal, those are remedies that could have been sought in that initial writ of habeas corpus, and were not. And I would also state to the court that the record does bear out that during these procedural dates, I mean, this defendant was represented by counsel, not the counsel here who's the appellate attorney, but during this, that there was counsel that was representing the defendant during every stage of this. I think the proper time to raise that motion for new trial would have been within that motion for out-of-time appeal as well.
And with regard to a habeas argument, simply asserting a as-applied due process argument with regard to the sex offender registry, and do you believe that that is a proper vehicle that Ms. Ferdinand has?
I think that the courts have encountered this previous, because we're not just talking about our kidnapping under an age, but also the unlawful restraint under 17 triggers that registration. And that she has deregistration available to her. And I don't put much credence in the argument that it would be untenable or no one would even know how to do this, because I think the facts of this offense would be laid out. An expert would be able to discern that, properly interview her, and then all the documentation and the court application could be made to deregister because of the way Chapter 62 is written and applied, that this is not a case of first impression, that this defendant in this particular not having a sexual motivation has been triggered into this sex offender registration, because we've seen this before.
But you do acknowledge that there, at least in this offense, there was no sexual behavior that this child that impacted this child.
I would absolutely say that the evidence bears that out, that this was a case of the defendant, the appellant here, who wanted custody of the child for the purpose of parenting, not for the purposes as stated by the court. Absolutely, we concede that.
So it's just some kind of interesting legislative anomaly that there is some sexual registration that goes along with this charge.
And I don't know if anomaly is the word I would use. However, I know that it has been the subject of discussion, and I know that there are district attorneys who've had those discussions in regards to this particular law, because even in cases of plea agreements and things like that, when we're discussing these offenses and that need for registration, that it's what's stated in 42A and Chapter 62 that's being followed by courts in this case.
And so from the state's point of view, what is Ms. Ferdinand's best pathway to clear up this registration issue? Is it habeas? Is it sometime in the future deregistration will impact her life, a registration that will impact her life forever?
I think deregistration is the legal path forward.
Okay, but that does not fix the fact that forever her life will be marred with a registration.
Well, when she is deregistered, I mean, we've already affected her life with the felony conviction in the beginning of that registration. She will then go off a registry. So I would say that's not a lifetime impact.
But anybody that looks at her history will know that she at one point was registered. It's not like you can expunge a registration.
I agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay. So her employment, her life will always be marked as at one point she was registered as a sex offender.
I think legally that would be the outcome, yes.
Okay.
There's a factual sufficiency question here, so let me just kind of walk through a couple of things. Previously, we discussed the acknowledgement of paternity, but there was also a filing, I think a recording of a rescission of that acknowledgement.
I believe that that was something that was denied by the parent himself. I'd have to go back and check that record. By the father, yes.
Okay. The appellants also presented evidence that they had applied for WIC benefits as well, and that's in the record, correct?
Yes, that would be from appellant's testimony.
Okay. Does the state deny that those benefits were requested by the appellant?
And I don't think we had any evidence on the record to controvert that now, Your Honor.
Anything further, Justice Theobanks? Anything further, counsel?
No, I would like to thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Yes.
Yes, ma'am. Unless anybody wants me to go into a specific direction, just a couple things, Justice Crump. On the rescission issue, so a lot is made about father's status as having rights. And I think that, yes, he's the biological father. And again, I want to make sure I'm not crossing a family law boundary that I am not sufficiently educated on. But if you go back and you look at Defendant's Exhibit 20, which is the longer body cam video from Officer Simmons. It's very interesting to me when Lieutenant Baumgartel, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, so the day before the trip, Officer Gloria, Officer Baumgartel, and then Officer Simmons, whose body cam footage we have, it shows us what happened at the house. It looks like it was about a 30-minute visit at the house. And that's when father presents the acknowledgement of paternity. And you'll hear Officer Baumgartel refer to the AOP as a paternity test and tell him, hey, like, this doesn't give you custody just because you have this. You don't have a birth certificate. Have you taken a paternity test? And even looking at the father's testimony at trial, mom's still out of the picture, and he's got the child to this day, I guess, without any formal documentation, even though he wasn't in the child's life for months. So the state cites the family code, I think it's 162, maybe 0.001 in their brief, and it talks about the elements of establishing paternity. And there's, I think, a really important part at the end, which is, and there's not a rescission or contested proceeding. We do have a rescission here. I know we cited Lugo in our sufficiency analysis, and I went back and I looked at, you know, all the evidence of rights, so to speak, of the father in Lugo, who was also charged with kidnapping, and there was more evidence about his rights than there is about the father in this case, significantly more. There was an amended birth certificate in Lugo, there was a paternity test, there was an AOP, and there was no rescission. So I think we've got an interesting issue, which again, I'm not a family law attorney, so I'm not gonna pretend to be, but I think that this continued characterization that, you know, dad's got all the rights in the world because he's just the biological father, I'm not sure that that's right. And I think we can debate the effectiveness of, yes, ma'am.
I just have a question, because Defendant's Exhibit 14 is the rescission itself. Whose signatures are on that rescission? I can't easily pull it up now, but.
May I grab it real quick to look
sure.
for you?
I have it.
I believe it is mom.
And if I read the instructions correctly, it requires certified service, so it's got to be sent in, and I don't, because that responsibility would not have been up to my client. I don't believe she was able to show any type of return receipt, and the state is correct. The father denied getting service, but he did say he was aware of the rescission. So I think, again, it is not a clear-cut issue where just because dad shows up in this 12 hours for the first time in the baby's life and from the state standpoint, revokes consent to move the child during this four-hour window, I think it's a lot more complicated than just saying he can do this because he's bio dad. And I think Lugo helps explain that that's a much more complicated situation.
He was with the child on the day of a birth, and your client said he came to visit two or three times. So it wasn't the first time the dad had seen the child. He had been there before.
Yes, ma'am. Correct. Yeah. Yes, ma'am. I'm not saying it was the first time he had seen her, but the first time he had, maybe the correct characterization is made a parenting type decision.
Gotcha.
Maybe that's the best way to characterize it. And I think he said five or six times that he had seen the child in 83 days.
And your client said he was dad.
Correct. Yes. She did acknowledge. She said, this is who I guess has been held out to be dad, although she also did add there may have been a question of paternity based on her personal knowledge of her friend's other romantic relationships. Yes, she did say that. So, Justice Crump, to answer your question about signature, mother's signature is at the bottom, correct? Just mother, I don't see a field for anybody else.
And with respect to the child support proceedings in which your client was the petitioner, mother also signed. Did she sign or was served with those pleadings? Do you know?
I've got it in front of me. I want to make sure I correctly answer your question. The letter, which is Defendant's Exhibit 15, is the letter from the Attorney General's office, signed by the Attorney General's office, but there is no field for any type of signature of a parent. So, okay.
But it identifies the mother as the non-custodial parent?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. So, all to say, my point in bringing that up is I think father's status is a lot more complicated than just saying he's the father, and so whatever he says goes. Now, I think that theory and trying to do that really benefited the state, because I think what's really going on behind the scenes here is law enforcement didn't really know how to handle this situation, as I imagine happens very frequently in maybe unconventional or untraditional family setups. And so they leave a infant in a position where they're not really sure if they did the right thing. And I think their way to feel like they covered themselves is, well, let's at least get it back to one person that we, you know, can at least say we feel comfortable with, because we know mom's still out of the picture. So all to say, I'd say please take a careful look at the issue of dad's status. I'm out of time, so I won't keep going if there's no more questions. I'll just close, if I may, with our request for relief. Please find that the evidence is legally insufficient to sustain the conviction and render a judgment of acquittal. Alternatively, please find that one or more errors in the jury charge caused her egregious harm, because it absolutely did. Or lastly, at a minimum, please give us back our out of time motion for new trial so we can challenge the injustice of her having to register as a sex offender under these circumstances. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you both, counsels. This case will be submitted. Thank you both for the good presentation. Thank you. The court will stand in recess.